Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
Well, how are you today, Rob? And Merry Christmas, Robert.
Merry Christmas, Russell Tovey. Today, Russell, I am feeling like I was born to mince.
You were.
I was.
100%. And
for those international listeners who might not understand the word mince, it's not cut up or grinded meat, ground meat, sorry. Grinded. That sounds like a dating app. It actually does mean walking with a short, quick step in an affectedly dainty manner, which is obviously me on a daily. But it's also partly why I am like that is because I was almost like given the agency to by today's guest, because in the mid-1980s, I was probably like 5-6 years old. And I remember he hit our screens and I used to sort of see him on BBC or ITV or different shows. And at the time, obviously those networks were where we all went to. It was kind of, you know, millions and millions and millions of people watching each of these evening shows. And from a really young age, the age of sort of 5, 6, 7, I was already like a ballet dancer. I was quite camp. I loved pop music. I loved Kylie. And the whole of my existence was quite different to the rest of the guys at school because they were all quite into rugby. They were like lads. And I just never fitted in. And for the first time on the screen, I saw someone like me. Obviously, they were an adult and they were very, very funny, which I wasn't. But they did give me agency and permission and a kind of strength to sort of stand up to the bullies and be myself. And I distinctly remember my brother, who's obviously now passed away, but I remember him being really into our guest today's comedy, because it was so kind of left wing and a relief from the conservative environment that we were growing up in. And it was almost, again, a way of realizing that there was another way of looking at the world. And even though we did love our parents and stuff, a lot of the time, the kind of culture we grew up in was so conservative, as it still is. And it's so wonderful. Our friend Susie just produced Friday Night Live, the kind of comeback version of it on Channel 4. And when I turned it on and saw our guest doing the most amazing stand-up, I was so relieved, because we need people like him right now. The world is so messed up. And I think it always probably will be, because human nature is just this horrible thing that just goes round in cycles. But we do have to keep fighting. And I think what better way to do that than through comedy and being funny and just speaking the truth. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art for our very special Christmas bonus episode, the wonderful Julian Clary.
Hello. It's quite a build up. I'm worried that I'm going to be a disappointment now.
You'll never be a disappointment. You're like the most iconic guest we've ever had, I swear to God. I love you so much. I know we've never actually met you, but big fan.
Oh, well, happy Christmas to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you. Well, we have met, Julian. We've met on a game show, panel show called Just a Minute.
Really?
Yes, I did that when you was on there. And we also share the same vet.
So yes, I think we met a vet a few months ago.
Now, that is glamorous. A celebrity vet. Love this.
I think Adele goes there as well, to be honest. I've heard that she's sometimes in there with her
pups. He's been my vet since I used to perform with Fanny the Wonder Dog
The
80s. And I used to live just opposite that vet is a housing co-op called Seymour Housing Co-op. That's where I used to live. So, yes, I used to go there with Fanny. And I still do. Fanny's long gone, of course. And you were clutching a French bulldog, I believe, Russell.
I have. Well, that's Rocky. Rocky's still here, and I have two Basset Hounds, Archie and Cooper. And yeah, that's our vet as well, and it's an amazing place. But dogs, let's talk about dogs then, because they are incredibly important to you. And you mentioned Fanny, who was part of your act when you first started on the comedy scene, and everyone associated you with Fanny the Wonder Dog. And you've always had a dog, and you've released a book called The Lick of Love, How Dogs Changed My Life. They've had a massive impact on you, and I definitely have that affinity with you.
Well, you'll understand how they enhance your life. That's kind of what I get from dogs. And I wanted to write another autobiography, but I didn't just want it to be showbiz stuff. So I thought if the focus is on the dogs and how in each chapter of my life there seems to have been a different dog sent to my side by some kind of higher force, it feels like, in that it was the right dog at the right time. So yes, I can't imagine. I've got Albert asleep next to me now. He is quite elderly. And upstairs, causing trouble, is Gigi. Neither of whom are Basset Hounds. They are, let's say, parents unknown kind of dogs.
So where do we find you? Because we find you slap bang in the middle of Panto season. So thank you so much for finding the time, because you must be exhausted, because you have like 9 shows a day, right, when you do Panto?
Well, we have 2 a day, 12 a week, and we've just done our first full week. So you do get zombified, you know, because there's nothing, no room left, no energy left for anything else. But when the call came to speak to you on Christmas Day, I thought, well, I'll make an effort, but I may have trouble stringing a sentence together. You find me in, I'm at home in a place called London, in Camden Town in North London.
And actually, you're sat in between two artworks as well behind you. There are two Damien Hirst works, I think, behind you.
Yes. What do you think? My husband, you know, they were sort of advertised just for a week, and if you wanted to order them, he would then make as many as were ordered. It was quite a clever money-making ruse.
We found drawn
into it, and he bought one for me and one for him. So his is that one, which is rather more attractive than mine, but they're very nice to live with. They're very cheerful.
And for those who can't see, obviously, all of our listeners, they are blossom trees, aren't they? They're kind of like in blue,
cherry pink.
Yeah, cherry blossom. So they're very kind of alluring works, I guess. Like, people love
blossoms. Touching yourself while you're speaking to me, Robert?
I am. I'm touching my shoulder.
Caressing your clavicle.
I'm actually touching my heart, because I just love Julian Clary that much. I've gone straight to the heart.
So are right that Damien is very good at money-making schemes when it comes to art. But as a collection, are you collecting contemporary artists or YBA artists, the young British artists, which Damien firmly belongs to?
I don't think so. I'm very fickle and think, if I see something, I've got my favourite's Peter Blake, because we like kind of cheerful, bright things. Oh, I've got what's that? That's Keith Haring opposite me.
They're
nice. I like things that are quite witty. And but no, I wouldn't say I'm collecting things. But we've almost run out of wall space because we've got such a lot of things. But it is anything from Noel Coward to Damien Hirst. And I've got a very sweet pencil drawing by Cocteau, which I must have bought 20 years ago. And it's a soldier asleep. And he's touching himself as well. His flies are undone. It's obviously a sort of post-coital nap going on. But that's nice.
What's the Keith Haring you have? What's that image?
It is one of those men just done in black, and his penis is erect, and it's turning into another little man who's fighting with someone next to them.
Oh, it's so good.
It's symbolic, I expect.
Has it got a red border?
It has orange border.
Yes. I know them. They're great. Obsessed.
And I never tire of it. Really nice things you don't tire of looking at, do you? Sometimes I did change the Keith Haring, because it's the first thing you see when you come into the house, into this room anyway. I changed it for a while for something else, and I missed it. So I had to go back.
So as you've, you know, they say about a really nice collection feels like a self-portrait. In some ways, you're looking at the works behind you that your husband bought for you and yourself. But like the Keith Haring, was this bought at a time in your life and the Peter Blakes when you had like a certain job and you invested in art or you were gifted it? Do you feel like you can recognize a moment in time by the art that you live with?
I went through a phase of buying things at auctions when you could do it online. It would be like, I think it was Christie's or something. And I had a bigger house at the time. And I would, and you can only see it on your screen as a tiny little image. I thought, oh, that looks quite nice. Lots of greens. I'll have that. And you get carried away bidding for things. And then they arrive and you kind of either like them or you don't. So I'm more likely to buy things if I'm walking past a gallery. There's one in Marylebone. Well, it's gone now, actually. It's called Railings. That's where I bought Peter Blake. In fact, I was walking past it with my mother and we stopped and I admired it. It's one of those sort of circular target thing with a heart, yes, heart in the middle. And anyway, we walked past it and then she bought it for me as a surprise for Christmas. And so that's sort of how I come by things. I never think I must add to my collection. That seems a bit too proper for me.
And you mentioned Noel Coward, and I know that you used to live in a house that he once lived in, obviously before our time. And I've weirdly recently been to that house for the new owner, which I won't say who it is because obviously they're very private, but it's the most amazing house. And I think it's even meant to be haunted, but I didn't feel like that to me. But is that why you also have Noel Coward's work in your house?
No, I bought the Noel Coward a long time ago from one of these auctions. The first one, which is of it looks like Venice, but it might be, might not be. It's sort of rather muscular, shirtless men on a boat with big poles. And I think there's
a running theme to your collection with kind of it's very, a lot of men appearing, a lot of like
it's all subconscious phallic symbolism.
And
the other one is a Jamaican one, but they're so lovely, his pictures, because, you know, he didn't think of himself as an artist particularly. It was done for him. It was his own sort of therapy and things. But when I lived in his house, I did, I had another one as well, a seascape one. So that was rather thrilling to bring them back to where they were painted. Maybe not the Jamaican one, but the others.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's an amazing, amazing property. Like, the gardens are so beautiful and it's so peaceful. It's in Kent and I live in Margate and it's like an hour drive from here. And I loved going there and I found it so magical to think that he was there. Do you have like an affinity, like a kind of connection to him?
Yes, you I do. Well, he was born in Teddington where I grew up and I used to cycle past his, there's a blue plaque outside the house in Waldegrave Road. And then when I got a bit older, I read his plays and his poetry in particular, I always really liked. And it was very me, you know, that that sort of obsession with trivia, really, and a refusal to take anything very seriously. I'm thinking of the plays, really. So they appealed to me. And then I acted in Private Lives when I was at university. And it was Paul O'Grady who told me that house was on the market. And,
I heard that. It's meant to be like a really, it's a tiny little kind of part of Kent, kind of almost towards Ashford. It's kind of that kind of side of Kent, I guess. But it's so beautiful there. But I heard loads of other people. I think Alan Carr might live there and there's lots of sort of forces of comedy there.
There's a lot of gays in the village. Yes.
Lots of gays. That's
a lot of rivals. Yeah.
There's the need for a cull, I feel. I do hope the new owner is looking after it. I'm glad you said the garden was still nice. He's not.
Yeah, totally looking after it. It's so extraordinarily beautiful, and I think they've done a lot of beautiful things there. I mean, it's stunning and filled with art as well, which is a great thing.
Well, I was there for 12 years, and I just felt the urge to pass it on to someone else, you know. And and I missed being in Camden, so.
Yeah.
Trouble with Kent, it's full of criminals, isn't it? You can cut that bit.
We won't. So we're talking about criminals. Your mother was a probation officer and your dad was a police officer, and yet your sister was a dancer, a showgirl, and you yourself went into entertainment. How did that absolute kickback from what your parents were doing to what their offspring were doing, how did that come about for you both?
Well, when you say offspring of a policeman and a probation officer, your listeners will get a certain sort of staid conservative image, but actually they were Scream, my parents. My father's no longer with us, but they were like comedy double act. And they were firing off each other all the time. My mother's very left-wing. My father was quite right-wing. So they were often coming to, not coming to blows, it's not, but you know what I mean? They were opposites attract, maybe. So it was, there were lots of heated debates at the dinner table. My mother was very funny. My father's like the straight man. So it was all about having a laugh. And I was having a difficult time at school on account of being an effeminate homosexual in a Catholic boys' school run by Benedictine monks. So that was difficult for me. But the reward was to save up funny stories for the dinner table. And that was be like sort of performance, really, to tell these anecdotes and make everyone laugh. Both my sisters were sent to dance classes from the age of three. And just because I think that's what you did with middle-class children. I wasn't sent because I was a boy, so I've always been slightly resentful of that. But my elder sister, Frankie, was very good at dancing and became a showgirl. And then I went to sit in her dressing room when I was, I remember it was Richmond Theatre, and I can't remember what show she was doing. But anyway, I was in this dressing room with all the girls and the feathers and the sequins, and at an impressionable age, I just thought something happened that night. You know, by the time I left that room, I thought, this is the life for me. I didn't know how I would get there, but turns out it was comedy, but I wanted it to be glamorous comedy. And also, I think all the things that were a problem at school, when I then left and went to Goldsmiths University, which is a very liberal place where you're encouraged to express yourself, and all the things that were a problem before, I decided to turn into assets. So I sort of became more of everything that I was beaten up for at St. Benedict's. And so that's when everything kind of came together, the glamour and the comedy. And yes, without thinking about it, this is all in retrospect, you can see that that's how things work out.
Have you played the Richmond Theatre? You must have done.
I have, many a time. I've done Panto there as well. Yeah, it's a beautiful
theatre. Did you ever have a moment when you first played it when you were like, I was in the dressing room here when I realised that this is the life I wanted and here I am on stage?
Well, I did go up to the girls' dressing room. I don't know if it's the same room, but it's one of those, you know, the ensemble are usually at the top of the building in the big long dressing rooms. Yes, no, I remember that night very clearly. They were all laughing and they were about, I don't know, 10 girls in there with the huge showgirl makeup. That was the thing. But I didn't want to be a female impersonator. I thought it's got to be male glamour.
And what was it like back, if you think like back to the mid-80s when you first sort of hit screens in everyone's houses across the UK, what was the response like, you know, when you go on the street and you'd meet people? Because it's, in a way, it was quite radical at the time. Like, I think it was really radical. I mean, the idea of seeing, like you're saying, kind of male beauty, this kind of eyeliner and makeup and even the incredible outfits you wore. Like, because to me, I love dressing up at that age. I was constantly wearing makeup, dancing, you know, wearing all, I would have loved to have worn all the costumes you were wearing. Mm-hmm. But I always wondered what, it was such a conservative time. Like, what was it
it's
like?
It's not too late, Robert.
Exactly. I've got to bring it back.
What was he it does, like? He makes an effort. Yeah.
I was doing the same thing on the alternative cabaret circuit for years, really. So from my point of view, it was just doing it in a different, doing the same thing in a different place with more support and people that shared the same ideas. So we had a very open-minded director, John Henderson, and we had a rather brilliant set designer, Anne Tilby, who took Chagall actually as her inspiration for those sets, and you can sort of see it somehow when you, if you watch any of them. So what we thought we would do would be create a world where that was my normality, and then getting the punters in to play the games on Sticky Moments, they were the ones who would seem out of place, if you see what I mean. So that everything was turned upside down. The surprise was I don't know if it was a surprise, the press, you know, the right-wing press didn't warm to me. And I remember being sort of pleased, I think, that I was upsetting the Daily Mail, because I would have felt uncomfortable if they thought it was great, you know. But it wasn't, my life didn't change that much. It was, I wasn't recognised without the makeup, so I could mince about. But the dog was, so Fanny was giving the game away all the time, so people would stop. And still, actually, people stop me with my current dog and recognise me, and then they ask, is this Fanny the Wonder Dog, who has been dead about 25 years? If it was Fanny the Wonder Dog, she'd be about 45. Which is very nice, because she retired about 10 years before she died as well. It's very nice that she's remembered. And I was in an airport in, I was in Auckland Airport, actually, some years ago. And someone came and spoke to me, and all they wanted to talk about was Fanny the Wonder Dog. So anyway, that gives me a thrill.
Aww.
And when I do tours now, I always mention Fanny the Wonder Dog, and she gets a posthumous round of applause.
Oh, so heaven.
Legend.
So you mentioned the alternative comedy scene and the circuit. What was the alternative comedy scene, for people that don't realise? Was it more like performance art, or was it just off the mainstream?
No, it was a reaction to the right-wing comics of the 70s, and it was sort of our mantra was it was non-racist, non-sexist, and so we were all basically very left-wing, and so were the audiences, and it grew suddenly from little rooms above pubs in the early 80s to the Comedy Store and Jonglers, and I used to do maybe, you know, a couple of shows a month to begin with. And a lot of the comics create their own venue in their local pub. And it suddenly became something else. And then Channel 4 was sniffing round, and they did Friday Night Live, which you mentioned. And so each week a different comic would be plucked from obscurity and put on that show. So it was, I don't really think any of us expected it to be a career at the time. I think we were just, it was a, where a lot of people who didn't fit in anywhere else ended up on that circuit. So it was mainly comics, but it was also singers and magicians, and it was proper variety of different, there was a man who used to play a vacuum cleaner. I can't remember his name. It was all sort of...
He played a vacuum cleaner? What do you mean? How do you play a vacuum cleaner?
He used to blow down the tube and make noises. That was his act.
Sounds incredible.
So it was me, Joe Brand, Paul Merton. There were a whole load of us who were still around, but that's where we all started. Paul Merton used to perform in his pyjamas at that time. I can't think why. And Joe Brand was known as the Sea Monster, and I was the Joan Collins fan club. So we were all in our own little world.
Well, you mentioned like the performances, and you know, and the fact that it was felt very British, I guess, at the time, and it was very political, left wing political, and it makes me think about panto a lot. And when I go and work abroad in the States, panto just isn't a thing. They just don't get it, and it's such a British mentality and sentimentality and a way of getting a message out there and entertainment. Do you find it kind of fascinating, the fact that how much we love panto and how much it does kind of define us? Like Morris dancing, for example, is something you can never explain. Do you think panto is an art form in itself, and why do you think we love it so much?
It's all different things thrown in. So, you know, it is a story, but it's, well, the ones we do at the Palladium are a variety act, but there's no fourth wall, so you're constantly breaking through the fourth wall to talk to the audience, then going back into a character. It suits me very well because you can't be told you're wearing too much makeup. You can't, you know, no one's going to say, well, that outfit is a bit extreme for panto. And I never imagined I could end up doing panto, but it is a world that actually suits me. And obviously I just play myself, whatever. I'm the spirit of the beans this year, apparently, but it, you know, it doesn't make any difference to my performance. Actually, it went horribly wrong last night. I come on as a giant sunflower at one point, and my face is appearing in the middle of a great big sunflower. And I've got this like a Alice band on with all these pointy things, which are like the stamen. And so I come on and I say to a woman in the front row, have you ever woken up with stamen on your forehead, madam? I think Americans that do come along, they don't leave totally stony-faced and baffled. I think they get it once they're there. It's just the idea of it. But it also has a sort of coziness to it in that somewhere along the line, good has to triumph over evil and everything has to be wrapped up and you have to have a warm glow about you at the end. That's one of the rules of it, I think.
But what do you think it is about, like, the British mentality that we have it, that we've created that?
Well, I could go on about Commedia dell'arte, and you know, you can trace it right back to what was performed in the villages of old England. So maybe it's in our blood somewhere, but I don't know about the British mentality. You tell me, Russell.
I don't really know. I mean, it's like the Carry On films. It's like we have this Benny Hill, you know, we have this big kind of cartoony energy, which we hold dear. I think it's the fact that we have sarcasm and irony. And it's something that, again, you go to other countries, they don't get it. It isn't a thing. But for us, we're able to kind of, you say something and within a split second, you can have a sarcastic or an ironic response straight away. And it just is in our nature. And I think that as a performance or a way of communication is very unique to us, you know, to the Brits.
Yes.
So you were mentioning Goldsmiths that you studied there. Was this where you studied your A-level history of art? No, that would have been after Goldsmiths.
Right? No,
before
I did drama and English at Goldsmiths. I wanted to do drama and history of art, but there was no such course at the time. But I did history of art A-level, and I had a really good teacher, so that, you know, how that works. You know, that sort of inspired me. Mr. Innes, and I remember a lot, whenever I watch University Challenge, I'd wait for the art round, and my husband's amazed at my knowledge. I'm amazed that I can still remember things. That's how good a teacher he was.
Well, you said this to me, and you said that he was able to explain and expand what everything meant, and you had a moment in an influential time in your life where you were mesmerized by this painting at the National Gallery, which was a Bronzino painting called An Allegory with Venus and Cupid. Can you talk about that moment? And this was your art teacher taking you to the National Gallery.
No, maybe it was. I think my friend Nick, I only had one friend at school, Nick. We used to go out mincing around art galleries and the National Portrait Gallery and the National Gallery. And I remember that was our favourite. We used to, because it's just stunning and it's huge. I think it's on a wall on its own and it's beautifully lit and everything. And they've got one of those nice little leather benches opposite, or they did have then. But yes, you're not going to ask me to explain the painting, are you?
No, I think I've just read a quote. Well, I would love you to, but you said that you love a painting with a story to tell. And this is a painting for you that has a story to tell.
Well, yes, it's all the figures in it are Venus, Folly, Time, and Mars. And one, there's a little girl sort of peering around in the corner, and you don't notice it straight away, but her thumbs are back to front. Her thumbs are on the wrong hand. I can't remember why, but it's part of the allegory.
Oh, so it wasn't a mistake by the artist who couldn't draw thumbs. It was a choice.
No.
It's not very hard.
Bronzino wasn't stoned that day or anything.
Well, you mentioned University Challenge and the round, how you always know the art history. So I've actually got three University Challenge questions about art history that I'd love you to answer. So for your starter for 10, here is your first question. Depicting an impoverished pea picker and her children in 1936, Migrant Mother was a celebrated image by which photographer? Dorothea Lange, Jack Delano, or Arthur Rothstein?
I don't know, because that's photography.
Mm.
I know all about, you know, Renaissance and things. So,
do you want to have a guess?
Russ, sorry to interrupt, but I actually know the answer because it's in our new talk book. It's actually in new talk book, yes. Elton John has it in his collection, which is why it's in
a pea picker.
Depicting an impoverished pea picker and her children in 1936, Migrant Mother was a celebrated image by which photographer? Dorothea Lange, Jack Delano, Arthur Rothstein.
Tim Walker, I'm going to say.
it's one of those three. It's a multiple choice, but you can have it.
Well, Robert's itching to tell us the answer, I can tell.
Dorothea Lange.
Yes. Second question. This is more contemporary. Polka dots and infinity rooms with mirrors are a characteristic feature of the installations of which Japanese artist born in 1929? Yo-Yo Kusama, Tatsuya Miyajima, Yoshimoto Nara.
You see, I thought Damien Hirst had cornered the market with polka dots. Did he nick it from someone else then?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm going to the bottom of the class. I don't know the answer to that either.
Rob?
It's number one.
Yo-Yo Kusama. Great. Third question. Here we go.
And actually, one of her mirrored rooms, these kind of labyrinth room things, is on display at the moment at Tate in London. And it's incredible. I think it's at Tate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tate Modern.
There's always a line to get in, but it's definitely worth waiting.
I went to the Tate about a year ago to see an exhibition. I can't remember what. And I couldn't find it. It's a very complicated art gallery, isn't it?
But did you go to Tate Britain or Tate Modern? Was it one or the other, and you maybe went the wrong one?
The one on the embankment.
Yeah, Tate Britain. Oh, no, it's Tate Modern as well. One's at the other end at Pimlico, and the other one's down by on the South Bank.
It was Pimlico. That's the tube station. Anyway, I was probably in the wrong building.
Final question. Okay, this is a Renaissance one.
It's very Christmassy, this question thing.
Which famous Renaissance painting finishes this set of four patriots? Let me start again. I'll finish. Which famous Renaissance painting finishes this set of four portraits by the same artist? Lady with an Ermine, Ginevra de Bency, La Belle Ferrantière, and what?
Ah, so it's Italian, obviously. Mm-hmm. Is it the Virgin? Are they all part of a sequence? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they're four portraits by the same artist. That if you know the artist, that would probably help you. Who painted Lady with an Ermine?
Lady with an Ermine? Might that be Raphael? No.
Rob, get off your phone.
My phone, I'm just checking.
It's the Mona Lisa.
Leonardo da Vinci. First thing I was going to say, you should always say the first thing. I'm claiming Canto brain. I couldn't think of any of those answers.
Absolutely. That's fine. But thank you very much for playing the game.
We loved it.
You got no points.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thinking about that British sensibility again, one of my heroes was Lindsay Kemp, and I was always really inspired by the way that he, you know, took mime to such an elegant, incredible place, but and dance and movement, but also the crossover with pop culture and like Mark Almond and David Bowie and Kate Bush and all of these people, because I used to make pop music and I just loved Lindsay Kemp. I think total icon. And I read somewhere that you thought Lindsay Kemp was really underrated, especially in the UK. Can you talk a bit about your admiration for Lindsay?
Oh, Lindsay Kemp. When I was about 16, 17, my sister was then dancing in a nightclub in Madrid. And I went to see her there. And because of David Bowie, I'd heard about Lindsay Kemp. And he was doing a show. And I said, there was a matinee on. And it was Flowers. And we went to see Flowers. And it was in a beautiful old, dusty old theatre. And I was completely mesmerised by what I saw. And that was it. I never stopped watching him after that and anything he did. And he didn't perform very often in this country because the critics were always very sniffy about him. And I don't think they quite got it. But to see him in Spain, or I saw him in Rome shortly before he died as well, with people that really appreciate him and in raptures. And as he got older...
He was 80 when he did that performance, right?
Yeah.
He was 80 when he died. I think. But he got old. He was one of those people who got better as he got older because it was more tragic. And there's a little video of him dancing to La Traviata, which lasts about 5 minutes, which I really love watching that because it's all sorts of different things. You know, it is funny and tragic and transporting. And when I went to Rome, someone recognised me and said, "Do you want to come and meet Lindsay?" And I thought, "No, I don't," because you know sometimes when you meet people you love, I wouldn't say it's a disappointment, but he was such a sort of constant in my mind. I didn't want to spoil that.
Yeah, it breaks a spell, doesn't it? Sometimes
I rather rudely said, "I'm all right, thanks."
All right, thanks. We're talking about meeting people you love, and I don't know if it is someone you loved, but you played an art historical figure called Lee Bowery in the Boy George musical Taboo, which was in 2002. You did the West End and the National Tour, and you played Lee, but you also met Lee in real life prior to playing him.
Well, yes, he was long gone by the time I played him, but I met him in the 80s. Well, I would be at the same clubs as Lee Bowery and George and that sort of set of people, Philip Salon. I was there to find a gentleman caller. They were there to sort of swan around and make an entrance, and then they would sweep out. So I didn't. I may have encountered him then, but I then met him. He interviewed me for a TV program, and we got on really well. So, yes, I did meet him.
But you also saw him perform as well.
Oh, yes, I saw him. I saw him perform with the... you're talking about the Enema performance.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know about this performance. This is like, you know, folklore. This is...
Yes, I think it was in Brixton somewhere.
The Fridge. I want to say the Fridge.
Maybe,
is that
maybe
right?
It was there. Anyway, he did this act where he would fill himself up rectally with water, and then he would swing over the audience on a rope and let it go. It would cause much outrage, and it was also very funny. It was another of those things that are two different things at once.
Do you think that people could do that now? Do you think if someone could, the act could appear now?
Yes, Bobby Davro should do it, shouldn't he?
That is his comeback. Yeah.
His career up. He used to give birth as well. He had, I can't remember who the girl was, but she'd be concealed because he was very large. This girl would be concealed upside down and he would lie back and give birth, and he would all sorts of bits of liver and stuff squirting out at the same time.
What was it like playing him?
Oh, it was great fun. Whether I was anything like him or not is debatable, but I could do a sort of Australian accent, and I love that musical Taboo, and I had those songs like Ich bin Kunst to do, and what's the other song? I say, oh, I've had a man or two. It's all about him cruising. He was a notorious picker-upper of men in anywhere he could, you know, toilets, Russell Square. I've had a man or two, and in fact, I've had a few in dark and dingy places. I can't remember anymore. But they were great songs to perform, and I used to shave my head and have the latex drips put on. Each costume change was a complete makeup change as well. So you'd be red raw at the end of the evening, and you'd have about three makeup artists, and you had to get in the shower for some of them between scenes because it's the only
really
way
to oh my god
yeah. Wow.
Do you like a theatre schedule? I mean, I when I do plays, you obviously get into the groove of it, but it is quite intense, and if you're saying that even within the production, you're not just on stage and doing it, you've got all these other affectations that are being thrown at you. Do you enjoy the process of doing a play or doing a stage performance?
I do. And the more brutal, the better, really. I mean, this panto I'm doing at the moment, some of my costumes aren't costumes, they're scenery. And so they have to be lowered onto me in the wings. And you only wear them for about a minute. But if I'm not on stage, I'm getting changed into something else. And you are dragged around, but it's fun, you know. And earlier this year, I did a tour of The Dresser playing Norman. That's another thing that, you know, I wasn't quite sure if I could do it. So I thought, well, I'll challenge myself because it's a big part. There's a lot to learn. So I like that as well. I don't think, the trouble is with being a comedian or being me, you know, you need to keep challenging yourself to do different things. So if it was constantly camp comedy, I'd get bored, we'd all get bored. So to do other things every now and then, that's why I do it, because I'm not sure if I can.
When did you first realise you were funny?
At the dinner table, I think, making my parents laugh. And Nick and I, our way of coping with the situation at school was to laugh about it. And I do think you were talking about how awful the 80s were in that, you know, it was Thatcher and all of that. And that's why alternative comedy, another reason why it came about, because it's a way of sort of diffusing things, and it's a weapon in or it can be a weapon. So, yes, it's very thrilling making people laugh, and addictive as well. And also, you also know where you stand, because if you're getting a laugh every 10 seconds or more, that's fine. That's a big tick. When I was doing The Dresser, which isn't particularly funny, no idea if you're any good or if people are enjoying it until you get to the end and they applaud or not. So it's good for the soul, I think, making people laugh.
Mm. We've spoken a lot on the podcast over the years with different artists who were living in New York during the AIDS crisis and the pandemic that was in the 80s. And I don't think we've spoken that much about it in the UK. And when It's a Sin came on TV recently, I was really struck by that, because I think culturally you often see the American perspective of it, which is equally, you know, emotional and important and vital. But I also, you know, it sort of made me realize when I was watching It's a Sin that I wasn't really that familiar with what it was like in London, you know, say during that time. And obviously you yourself were, you know, living in London at that time, you were gay. And can you talk a bit about the AIDS crisis and how humor maybe helped you survive in a sense?
Yes. Well, I'm trying to think, you know, we didn't really know what was going on for a lot of the time in the early days. You know, be all these rumors, don't sleep with an American, whatever you do. And then people were kind of disappearing. And it wasn't only humor, but it was the whole thing of partying in the face of adversity, because what else could we do, you know? And that going out and having a good time became a kind of statement in itself. And my friend Stephen, who died in, I suppose, around 91, I think he died, or maybe I may have got that wrong. He was very ill, and he was in the Broderick ward of the Middlesex Hospital. But he would phone me up and say, let's go out, you know, and he would slip out of his pajamas and put his leather jacket on, and we'd go out to heaven or whatever. And then he'd go back to his hospital bed, and, you know, I mean, they weren't thrilled about it, the nurses, but that was the sort of thing that we were doing, and maybe it was avoiding the reality as well. But we weren't weeping into our handkerchiefs so much. It's not my recollection. And then when people died, you sort of, well, I sort of felt you have to live your life for them. So you couldn't let it bring everything to a halt. You had to carry on.
Well, there's incredible figures in the 80s that stand out and that were living through it and commenting on it, and in some ways controversially commenting on it, people like Quentin Crisp, who's had very kind of controversial opinions to being homosexual. But you hung out with Quentin Crisp and you had this amazing time with him. He had a motto that if you bought him a meal, he would hang out with you. And you had that experience with Quentin Crisp in the 80s in New York, right?
I did. We were filming a peculiar program called Desperately Seeking Roger, which was about my search for Roger Whittaker and meeting lots of people along the way. So I did meet Quentin Crisp. And I mean, when Nick and I were at school, his book came, The Naked Civil Servant, came out, and it was a bit like a Bible to us, because, you know, one of his phrases where it was about life was like a dash from cradle to grave under heavy gunfire, or something like that. And that was how life felt for us. And for all his controversial views, which came out later, at the time, he was like a warrior, you know, who would to live the way he did during the war and so on. Yes, Quentin Crisp. They don't make them like him anymore, do they?
No, and you went to Staten Island with him.
On the Staten Island ferry, yes. It was funny because he, I don't know how old he was then, but you got the impression whatever question you asked him, he had like four anecdotal answers ready, and he would just reel one out. You know, I lift one pale hand, or whatever it was. Why, well, I like living in New York because you could hail a taxi quickly. But they were sort of set pieces, which is fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you said talking about books, and as well as being a comedian and an actor and a presenter, you are a novelist, and you have had, you know, Sunday Times bestsellers, and you're currently creating this whole children's book narrative, The Bolds, which I think you have 8 books so far, and you've sold like 700,000 copies or something, which is incredible. And it's about this family of hyenas in Teddington, where you're from, and they are illustrated by someone who's very in demand called David Roberts. And I'd love you to just talk about that whole process of, you know, because for me growing up, and I'm for Rob as well, I think illustration and children's books were so important. And Quentin Blake and Roald Dahl, for me, feel so entwined. And them images are so important to me growing up from them novels. And them novels, especially as a kid, were important. What was it like for you writing these children's books and then finding an illustrator who you felt was really sensitive to your words?
Well, they're very heavily illustrated. They're very popular with children that are reluctant readers, because I think when you pick them up, you see lots of drawings. Well, we were put together by it was the publisher's idea, really. And I'd written the first book by then. And there are 4 main characters, Mr. and Mrs. Bold and the twins, Bobby and Betty. They're all hyenas living disguised as human beings in Teddington. And he did a sort of portrait of each character. And it was just one of those moments where it was exactly how I'd pictured them in my mind.
Wow.
Kind of got it. And he writes very precisely. The lines are very clear. So it's not all fuzzy and sketchy. And he's very interested in like the wallpaper so there'll be a scene in the Bold's lounge where they're all having a laugh, as hyenas do. You can look at the same picture for ages, because he will go into great detail about the wallpaper, and it's because it's set in the 70s, where I grew up in Teddington in a house just like the Bolds. He's gone into that whole world of 70s fabrics, and he used to be a milliner, and Mrs. Bold makes her money by making hats out of unusual things like birds' nests and mud and things she finds on the rubbish tip, and sells them at Teddington Market. So that was of great interest to David Roberts, because that's his world. And Mrs. Bold wears a big caftan, which is something he saw, I think, in the V&A and wanted to recreate it. But as we've gone on with the books, I now know what sort of things he will be interested in illustrating. So you don't have to write as much. I don't have to describe it, because I know it'll be in the drawing. They've actually finished now, the Bolds. The last Bolds book, The Bolds Go Green, finishes with a big party in Bushy Park. And it was only when I was writing it, I realised that it was a finale, because all the characters from all the previous books were there celebrating the twins' birthday. So I thought, oh, that's a finale. That must be the end of that. Because when you've written a lot of books of the same characters, they kind of speak to you. They tell you, they live in your head, and they tell you what's going to happen. And they announced it was the end. So that's that.
Wow. You must feel incredibly proud of that.
Well, what's lovely is I'm used to making adults laugh. And it came about because my literary agents, I'd written three adult novels and no one bought them much. And she said, oh, well, everyone's interested in children's books at the moment. And it was another of those things where I didn't really think I could write for children. So I thought, I'll have a go. But making children laugh is such a thrill because they don't know who I am or care, you know. They're children from 7 to 10, which is a lovely age because they're very, very accepting of unusual storylines, shall we say.
Are you writing more books now or going to work with David or another illustrator, more children's books?
I am writing another book, but it's not for children this time. It's a murder story.
You know the hyenas then? So there was a part of the research for this episode which I totally threw me. I never knew you did a TV show called Nature Nuts, which was all about the kind of tour of the UK, wildlife lovers. And you actually met a painter who's like a wildlife artist called Robert E. Fuller in one of the episodes, who'd been like finding all these amazing species of animals and then making artworks of them. Can you speak a bit about that whole project and why wildlife is such a big thing for you?
Yes, it is. And Robert Fuller is he makes lovely little videos. He lives in the Yorkshire Dales and he's always setting up cameras to film birds or rodents or owls. He took me into this upper tree, like a sort of a hideaway where you could watch these owls just a few feet away. It was an unusual program because it was a sort of synthesis of comedy and a nature program. And they let me sort of do what I wanted with it. So we were going to meet people who were obsessed with different types of animals and with specialized cameras, film them in the way that they'd never seen before. So I was swimming in the North Sea with seals, with some man who liked seals. And I went up to Scotland to investigate the beavers. That was a very nice episode. Yes, no, I loved that program. And I was sorry it wasn't recommissioned. I think we did six episodes and that was that, gone. The cutthroat world of television.
You met an artist on there. What was you saying, Rob? What was the artist doing?
Robert Fuller. Yeah, he paints all sorts of animals, but he paints birds of prey in particular with very detailed things of each feather, you know, how they're all speckled and all of that. And he's very handsome.
That's a plug for him. And he's handsome as well. Very good. Birds of prey and he's handsome.
He's really talented. Check. They're really beautiful, beautiful wildlife paintings.
Well, before we got into our last question, do you have, like, you said you had like a coming of age moment, I guess, in front of this Bronzino painting, but do you have regular visits now? I know you went to the Tate and you couldn't find the show you wanted to see, but do you go to like the National Gallery and the National Portrait Gallery when that reopens again? Are these places like regular destinations for you?
No, they're not really. sometimes the atmosphere in galleries and museums is a bit overpowering. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of serious and worthy, and it doesn't suit me really unless I'm in that sort of mood. There's so much in them as well, isn't there? Mm-hmm. I'd like to see one or three paintings rather than a whole load.
But I know, I think your feelings about art galleries is what a lot of people who are listening to the show feel. They feel like an either intimidation or they feel overwhelmed with information, or they have an anxiety about how they're supposed to perform or be or how to navigate through a space. It is overwhelming, definitely. And I think that you walking in and feeling a kind of guilt about not spending time there, or a guilt about not respecting it enough to stick around. But I think that's also completely valid as well.
Yes, I think it's that feeling of not belonging, or, you know, not understanding, which makes me head for the exit.
Yeah, but I think that is the majority of museum goers. And I think that is, you know, things like what you're doing for Panto is incredible, because, and good Panto and good theatre, is that when you're a kid, if you see something like that, it can change your life. You know, you went into your sister's dressing room, it changed your life because you was around that energy and you could see it happening. There's so much bad stuff being made that they just like bust people in to go and see it. And there is this sort of thing. I remember seeing stuff when I was younger and I didn't get it and it wasn't very good. But I thought, well, it's on stage or it's on the gallery walls. It's obviously better than I think it is, because it's there So I'm the bad person. I'm the person that doesn't really get it. And actually, it takes a lot of going and a lot of, you know, opportunities to see things, to work out your own critical eye and to work out your own like loves, your own things that you're drawn to. And I think it's the same with, you know, you go and see as many loads of movies, or you listen to a certain artist's album, or you read a certain writer's books, and you're able to critique them. The more you go to see exhibitions, the more you're able to critique shows, curations, the artist movements, the art, the way the artists like are connected to other artists within a generation, intergenerationally between contemporary artists now and, you know, old masters, for example. But it takes a discipline of going and seeing and looking and giving yourself that time to work out what your critical eye is and what you like.
Yes. And also what you feel, really. For me, looking at a painting is how it makes me feel, is a sort of fairly immediate response. And I need to feel uplifted, really. That's what I like.
Yeah, and it seems like that's what your collection is. That's the things you're surrounded by are very uplifting, poppy, bright, strong,
but positive. I hear what you say about the more you see, the more you're... It's like anything, isn't it? The more buggery jokes I write, the more that occur to me, because I can see filth everywhere I look.
and the more shows you do with the word mince in as well, then the more you can mince.
I've done a lot already. I've done
you have, you have. Mince, you've inspired us all.
So it goes on.
Right. Well, we ask every guest two questions at the end of the episode. The first is, if you could do an art heist and steal any artwork or object, or it could be anything from around the world, what would it be? We can help you with vans or cranes or helicopters, whatever you may need to help you do this art heist.
Okay. So does it have to be a painting?
It can be anything you want.
Anything. Okay. A costume.
I'd like the crown jewels then.
Right.
They're beautiful, aren't they? Yes.
Beautiful.
You'd look really good at them.
Would you wear them or...
Yes, all those lovely sparkly diamonds and things. Yes, okay, that's my answer to that.
There you go.
Okay, what? And talking about diamonds, I heard you have an amazing wedding ring or engagement ring that's quite it's like S&M. But there it is. I was desperate to see it.
It looks like...
Can you talk us through it?
Ring, doesn't it, frankly? But it's not. It is ceramic because metal makes my finger go funny. But if I got really cross one day and smashed my hand, it would break. And it's got one tiny diamond chipping. Can you see that? Which one is it?
You're holding it up to the camera, yeah. Lovely.
Anyway, there you are.
Amazing. What is your favourite colour, Julian, and why?
Oh, well, I like blue, but I wouldn't paint a wall blue, you understand. I couldn't live in a blue room, but I like wearing blue. I like orange very much.
Rob loves orange.
My husband's very minimalist, you know. I'm thinking of decorating now for some reason. He's obsessed with jasmine white, and that's all we're allowed to have on the walls. But there's a lot of art covering them up, covering up the jasmine white.
Great. So jasmine white by proxy and blue.
And orange.
And orange, yes. Amazing.
There's not any colours I don't like, really. So,
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
I know that your mum told you the best advice was just say yes, and it worked to a positive when you did the Big Brother because you was doubting that, but a negative when you ended up doing crystal meth at the Cock in New York City. So there's a bit of a...
No, my mother does tell me to say yes, and my mother's a big influence in my life, and I always ask her advice if there's anything I'm not sure about, you know, like shall I go on Big Brother or shall I do this, that or the other. And she says generally you have a more interesting life if you say yes rather than no, and that's true, isn't it? You know, if you in terms of invitations or anything, if you say no all the time, then you're probably missing out.
Well, thank you so much. Well, let's talk about the show you're in then. So currently you're in Jack and the Beanstalk pantomime. So how much longer is the show on for?
Oh, well, it goes on till January the 15th.
Great.
And where is it?
It's at the Palladium, the London Palladium.
Great. And you've got a website that everyone can go and check out what's coming on and come see your stand-up. And are you performing again?
JulianClary.co.uk, isn't it?
great?
Yes, I think so. I think, do people still look at websites?
I guess so. Or you're on Instagram, aren't you?
Instagram now, don't they?
Julian Clary, renowned homosexual on Instagram.
Is it? Is that your IG on there?
That's my handle, yes.
Julian, thank you so much for talking to us on this Christmas Day. You have made my Christmas dreams come true. It's the best present I ever could have wished for. And thank you for being you and being so generous in the world. And
exactly.
Yeah, for being a renowned homosexual. Gives all of us homosexual strength.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For everyone listening, we will be posting images on the Instagram feed of the artists and things we've been discussing today. And please have a lovely Christmas, everybody listening. See you all soon. And thank you very much, Julian. Bye, everyone.
We'll be back very soon. Thanks, Julian. Thanks for listening. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.